Friends, our Bible reading this morning is found in the book of Genesis, chapter 37. And I'm reading from verse 12. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." He answered, "Here I am." So he said to him, "Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring word back to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron. He came to Shechem and found a man, and a man found him wandering in the fields. The man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I'm seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, please, where are they pasturing the flock?" The man said, "They have gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from a distance, and before he came near to them, they conspired to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we shall say that a wild animal has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he delivered him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but lay no hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand and restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, a long robe with sleeves that he wore, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, with their camels carrying gum, balm, and resin, on the way to carry it down to Egypt. And Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers agreed. When some Midianite traders passed by, they drew Joseph up, lifting him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes. He returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone, and where can I turn?" Then they took Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. They had the long robe with sleeves taken to their father, and they said, "This we have found. See now whether it is your son's robe or not." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. A wild animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned his son for many days. All his sons and all his daughters sought to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted, and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning." Thus his father bewailed him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. Amen. Friends, this morning we are going to build on what we considered last week. And if you recall, we considered the issue of despair, why certain things happen the way they do, and how we try and make sense of them. This morning, we are going to consider the problem of evil. And we are going to see if the Bible has anything in its pages to help us understand. A question that's often asked is how? How, for example, can God allow X, Y, or Z to happen? How can God allow innocent people to die in war? How could God allow a youngster to fall to a death like we saw last week? More broadly, how is it, if God is good, that there seems to be so much evil in the world? It's the question that broadsides people's faith like no other. It is thus a serious question, and it therefore needs to be taken very seriously. Some have said that either God cannot prevent evil or God chooses not to. If He cannot, they say, then God is not all-powerful. And if God can choose but chooses not to, then God is not all-good. But is it that cut and dried? In order to counter this, others have said that we just cannot know. We cannot fathom God, and we shouldn't even consider such questions. But do we find that in the Bible? And the answer is an emphatic no. In fact, when we consider the Bible, we find some astonishing passages, astonishing in their openness and astonishing in their honesty. Here's Jeremiah in chapter 12, verse 1 of the book of Jeremiah. You will be in the right, O Lord, when I lay charges against you, but let me put my case to you. Why does the way of the guilty prosper? Why do all who are treacherous thrive? Here's Habakkuk. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not listen? Or cry to you violence and you will not save? Why do you make me see wrongdoing and look at trouble? Destruction and violence arise before me. Strife and contentions arise. So the law becomes slack and justice never prevails. The wicked surround the righteous. Therefore judgment comes forth perverted. Far from seeking to paper over the cracks or sweeping such questions under the proverbial rug, the prophets instead bring all the issues to the fore. In fact, when one casts an eye over the pages of the Bible, especially over the Hebrew Scriptures, it becomes abundantly clear that those who raise such issues and question God's justice weren't heretics or skeptics or deniers of the faith. They were just the opposite. What we might call the heroes of the faith did such things. Moses, the prophets, even the psalmist, my God, why have you forsaken me? Think about our friend Job, who wrestled in pain and anguish with the things of God and yet received no clear answers as to the question of his suffering. You know, his friends tried to comfort him by seeking to explain why he was in anguish and why God permitted evil. But God said of them they were wrong, and Job, the one who cried out, the one who questioned why, was right. Now we call what they were doing a theodicy. And a theodicy is an attempt or a response to explain or make sense of the evidential problem of evil in this world with regard to God. But what we witness in a book like Job is the blocking of such a thing. And so we have to ask why. In his book, The Great Partnership, Jonathan Sacks delivers this answer. There is a left brain and a right brain way of asking the question of why there is unjustified evil in the world. The left brain, philosophical, analytical way is to ask it hypothetically. What would we expect the world to be like if there were an omnipotent, omniscient, good God? No child would die. Perhaps no adult would die. Animals would not hunt for one another for food. There would be no sickness, no poverty, no hunger. No one would be homeless or without access to pure water and medical treatment. There would be no earthquakes, no tsunamis, or if there were, there would be no loss of life. The world is not like that. Therefore, there is no God. That is the philosophical way. It's not the way of an Abraham or a Sarah. It's not the way that they would ask the question. The religious mind begins not with the world that might hypothetically be, but with the world that is. There is suffering and injustice. There is sickness and premature death. There are natural disasters. That is the world we inhabit, and for the time being, there is no other. The religious mind starts with the world that is, not with the world that might have been. Within this world, it seeks meaning. It does not seek explanation. Explanation is something else. Through explanation, we learn how tsunamis happen, how populations suffer from sickle cell anemia or become infected by AIDS. The religious question is about meaning. But what sort of meaning? Well, generally speaking, there are three responses to this question. The first being that this is not the only life there is. That when we pass from this place with all its suffering and injustice, there is heaven, a place of peace where all evil and suffering is banished. That in heaven, we will find justice and truth, and indeed we will find God. Of course, this is an important belief. And it is spoken of in the Bible, and it does bring great comfort. But is it the whole answer? It seems not, especially when one considers Jesus telling his disciples that they should pray that God's kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. When one considers the fact that God's response to the Israelites suffering in Egypt wasn't "be calm and bide your time patiently because a better world awaits you." The second response says something like this: we suffer through life in order that we might grow. And others suffer so that we might be good to them. In other words, we battle through life and suffer in order that we might grow in goodness. It's an opportunity, therefore, to become better people. Now, as a response to suffering, this understanding makes sense. But as a justification for suffering, it stinks. As it means then that those who suffer are for others a means to an end. It's a response that is in danger of turning life into one big game. The third response says there is evil, therefore there is no God. The world is as it is, random, chaotic, dog eat dog, without justice, without a judge. We cannot expect any better. And if there is a God, there should be no evil. Sachs calls these philosophies of acceptance, as that is what they have in common. But is that the way of the Bible? Gritting our teeth, waiting for heaven, working out our acts of goodness so that we might get better, using others to hone our goodness. Evil, no God. God, no evil. Left-brain logic. Well, no, it isn't. What we witness in the Bible, in the religion of the Bible, is something else. We do not see simple acceptance, but we do see protest. We do not see left-brain thinking, cold and analytical. Instead, what we see is seeing both sides of the contradiction. The reality being that God exists and evil exists. We do not see men and women simply throwing in the towel and saying, so that's the sum of it. We do not see resignation. Instead, we hear a cry. The cry of Moses, the cry of Jeremiah, the cry of Habakkuk, the cry of Job. And in the New Testament, we hear the cry of Christ. And these were not the cries of skeptics or cynics, but men grounded in God, who would not be comforted by theodicy or clinical explanations for the contradiction, but also would not let go of God. Why? Because they lived in hope. In our reading today, we read the story of Jacob, who sent his beloved son Joseph to see how his brothers were doing. The brothers were jealous of Joseph, as he was their father's blue-eyed boy. At first, they contemplated killing him, but decided on another way of getting rid of him, so they sold him into slavery. And then they faced the problem of what they were going to tell their father Jacob. So they killed a goat and smeared its blood on Joseph's coat. And then they took their coat, the coat to their father and told him that they had found it and wanted him to verify whether it was Joseph's coat or not. Recognizing the coat, Jacob exclaimed, "It is my son's robe. A wild animal has devoured him. Joseph, without doubt, is torn to pieces." We are told that Jacob tore his garments and put on sackcloth and mourned his son for many days. And all his sons and daughters gathered around him to bring him comfort. But he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning." Why did Jacob refuse to be comforted? After all, he knew that all life must end. That in his religion, there was a time for mourning. Yet excessive mourning was understood by his people to be a rebellion against reality. So why did he refuse? Because he refused to give up hope. He refused to give up hope in the face of evil. Without the evidence of his son's body, he refused to give up hope that Joseph was still alive. And of course, we know that Joseph was still alive, but that's another story. In the same way, we are called not to be comforted, but to live in hope. For those who hope cannot be comforted whilst evil still abounds. This means then that hope isn't the same as optimism, but that hope often comes at a price. A quote attributed to Edmund Burke, the Irish political philosopher, says, "All that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing." And therefore, hope implies action. Action which seeks to right that which is wrong. An example of which we witness in the life of a man like William Wilberforce, who after converting to Christianity was urged to lead the fight against the slave trade by anti-slave trade activists, a movement that had its roots in Quaker anti-slavery committees. And for 26 years, they battled this scourge, suffering ill health and doubt and the ridicule of others, yet they never gave up hope. In 1833, the Slavery Abolition Act came into being, and 3 days after hearing that the passage of the act was assured, Wilberforce died. I'm pretty sure that there were times when Wilberforce would have settled for acceptance, believing that he and his friends were powerless to act against the forces that seemed to be so strong. Yet they refused to be comforted. They refused to give up hope. They refused to believe that evil would ultimately triumph. We know today that they were right. And behind it all, driving them onwards, was their belief in God. The Bible then tells us the story about Adam and Eve and how they went against God by eating the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But it doesn't go into great explanation or detail about the creation of evil. It lets us know that evil exists and that human beings have the capacity to commit evil acts. But it also lets us know that God exists and that in God there is hope. And that hope doesn't leave us in a place of weak resignation, but it moves us to act. In the words of Micah, to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with God. Now, I would like to end my message with a quote from a book I have mentioned already. And I've used it to gain information for my message today. It's a quote from The Great Partnership, subtitled God, Science, and the Search for Meaning by Jonathan Sacks. He writes these words, "Belief in God is an assertion of human dignity in the face of humiliation and hope in the midst of the dark night of despair. It is a refusal to accept evil as inevitable, but at the same time an acknowledgement that we cannot leave redemption entirely to God. He rescued Noah, but Noah had to build an ark. He dwelt among the Israelites in the wilderness, but they had to build the sanctuary. The very fact that the Bible devotes some 15 times as much space to the Israelites constructing the sanctuary as it does to God creating the universe tells us that our deeds are precious to God. God is not the solution of a contradiction, but a call to become His partners in the work of redemption. If I did not believe in God, he continues, what would persuade me to fight against an injustice that, according to Nietzsche, is written into the basic biological structure of life itself? There were two major forms of social hope in the 20th century. One was the Marxist vision of the proletarian revolution. The other was the Western dream of peace, market economics, and technological progress. The former led to the loss of freedom, and the latter to large and growing inequalities. Hope for the few, but not the many. The risk is that in the 21st century, people will increasingly turn to pessimism, resignation, endurance, and what the Greeks call ataraxia. They are what the Greeks found refuge in when they lost faith in faith. Lose belief in God, and sooner or later you may lose belief in the possibility and necessity of justice. Herbert Schneidau used the phrase sacred discontent to describe the Hebrew Bible's contribution to Western civilization. The historian Christopher Dawson argued similarly that alone amongst the civilizations of the world, Europe has been continuously shaken and transformed by an energy of spiritual unrest. He attributed this to the fact that its religious ideal has not been the worship of timeless and changeless perfection, but a spirit that strives to incorporate itself in humanity and to change the world. This energy is driven by the cognitive dissonance of a faith that sees the world as it is while refusing to let go of its vision of the world as it ought to be. In that world, contradiction is to be resolved not by philosophical thought, but by a redemptive deed. And the quote finishes with these words, perhaps this is not the world that we would have chosen, but it's the only one we have. Either we resign ourselves to the evil it contains, or we register a protest against it. It begins with a cry that is only stilled when we hear the judge of all the earth calling on us to help bring justice into the human world that we make together. Evil exists, God exists, and we are called to be light in the world that we live in, and not called to give up hope. Amen.